The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to the first episode of the Guardian Voluntary Sector Network podcast. My name is Bertie Boredon, and in the next few months, I will be inviting leaders of the UK voluntary sector around a table to discuss various challenges the sector is facing. For the first episode, we will be talking about fundraising. I have three guests.
Hi, I'm Tanya Steele. I'm Director of Fundraising at Save the Children.
Hello, Tanya.
Hi, I'm John Brewer. I'm Charity Technology Trust's Director of Development.
Hi there, and I'm Mark Bishop, the Director of Fundraising at Prostate Cancer UK.
Well, first of all, thank you for accepting to take part in this first podcast. In the current economic climate, it may be difficult to maintain good fundraising ratios. Tanya, have you made any changes to your fundraising portfolio in the past few years?
Yeah, I guess we have. We probably didn't start from the premise of ratios. We started in terms of what the organisational goals were, and we went through a piece of strategic work to look at our ambition for children. And it was pretty clear that based on that ambition, which is to make dramatic change to children's lives, we were going to need to raise a lot of money. So we had to put a very different pair of glasses on, if you like, when we started to consider how and where we might go about raising those funds.
Does that resonate with you, Mark? Did you change your portfolio? Because I know obviously Movember is one of the major campaigns for.
Well, I think you know, we started very similar to you actually, Tanya, in the sense that you start with what you need to achieve and then work your way back from that. But as you say, Bertie, we're blessed by the magic of moustaches at Prostate Cancer UK. So for folks who've not had the experience to do Movember, each November we ask guys to grow a moustache for 1 month. And it's 54,000 minutes of time, of FaceTime there, and to fundraise. And in the most recent campaign, over £20 million has been raised from people growing moustaches. We've had, hundreds of thousands of people doing it. And it's just one of these things that comes along that transforms the fortunes of our charity and hopefully transforms the fortunes of men's health. The challenge for us is to make sure that all the rest of our fundraising is growing rather than just resting on our laurels and letting moustaches do all the work.
Does this source of income helps you to fund other type of activities?
In terms of the charity's work, well, it's allowing us to do research that we would never have been able to do and survivorship services that we never wouldn't have had the money to do. And actually, what Movember's been doing for us is helping us win other partnerships because it wakes people up to men's health. They do a moustache for a month, get their mates involved. And at the end of the month, and the amazing parties that take place, people go, I wonder if there's something else I could do for Prostate Cancer UK and run a marathon and stuff like that. So we're finding that Movember is almost the way to start the conversation with people.
Mm-hmm. I really agree with that. I mean, I think Movember, apart from the fact I can't grow a moustache, I'm glad to say, but it's been an amazing runaway success. I mean, just huge. And I think for me, it speaks to a number of things within fundraising is sometimes you need to back a few horses and actually start to see what emerges. And Movember has obviously been an enormous catalyst, but you can't necessarily just back one idea. But then when you do see something that's starting to work, then it's starting to focus behind it because it's very easy to spread things too widely. So when we re-looked at our investment and our fundraising in Save the Children, we found that we had what we called a very long tail, a lot of activity that actually at times was quite marginal to the benefit. So it's actually culling it back and actually focusing around some very big initiatives that actually are going to engage, in your case, Mark, millions, which is outstanding.
And it starts to sound like the Mutual Flattery Society, but you guys love the whole Born To side of things, the way it thematically kind of works. It just opens people's minds and to different ways of kind of working with you. So I think you've come up with a way of structuring your fundraising that it brings a lot more people in.
Definitely.
And maybe that I've got the wrong impression, but my impression is that Movember is very much around crowdfunding and happening in the public, where some of the campaigns I've seen from Save the Children really resonate possibly more with corporate partners. And I've seen that Save the Children have got a big portfolio.
I mean corporate partnerships has grown hugely for us, so if I was to talk about the areas that have grown most, there is no doubt corporate partnerships and let's say mass giving, or sometimes it's called individual giving. And I think we've started to approach our corporate partnerships differently. I mean, first of all, I think you do need to put forward a very big and inspiring idea for an organization to want to get behind it at any scale. And we're also starting to look at how can we link what we do with an organisation's core business. So it's great to be a charity of the year or a charity partner, but actually there's an awful lot you can do much more directly working together. What assets has that corporate got that could help your cause? But actually, are there things through to how its supply chain works, where it works in the world, maybe some joint product development? So those are new areas that we've very much started to work on. And I guess in addition to that, we found increasingly our corporate partners are giving us more visibility in the consumer marketplace, which is really key for us as well.
So the changes you're describing sounds a bit like working more with commercial organisations is slightly the model of social enterprise. So I want to know, John, if you've seen that the charities you're working with or working for have also adapted their fundraising portfolio.
Well, I think certainly from a technological point of view, I mean, you'd imagine me instantly bring up technology working with the Charity Technology Trust. But it was interesting just hearing that conversation already, how important technology is as an enabler to everything that's going on. And certainly Mark's experience with Movember, how critical social media, is to all of that. And so technology is there, underpinning a lot of what's going on these days. Sometimes quietly, sometimes not so quietly. From our point of view, I think we see technology very much as a strategic issue. We're trying to encourage more charities to get more strategic about the way that they see their IT, and not just that it's about refreshing your aging hardware when it's just about to crash. So certainly, we've got examples of people who are looking more at their data in general at the moment, being more aware of the way that data can be held in different systems and that you can bring those things together to get a better picture of your supporters. And how important it is then to be able to use that to be more targeted, reaching out to specific segments and giving the right content to the right people. So that's certainly a big help for ratio management.
So I'm wondering what's driving this change, if it's time or if it's necessity in a way.
I mean, if I start on that, I think a lot of this is to do with increased competition. So if somebody chooses to support you, the best thing to do is to keep the supporters supporting you in the future, not losing to another charity. And I think the other thing is that consumer attitudes are changing. People don't just chuck a pound in the bucket and say, well, I've done my bit for charity. People want to know what the difference is in terms of their money. And the charities have a responsibility now to report back to people. So I think that technology allows us to stay in touch with people better and be more accountable for, the funds they've given us to make sure it's making a difference.
I think also we're increasingly becoming consumer-driven businesses as well. And the kind of interaction and engagement that you see with many high street or household brands is at times fundamentally different from an interaction that you might get with a charity brand. But I think there's a huge opportunity for us to start to step into that space. And we've lagged. I mean, certainly in terms of technology investment, most of us are struggling through our databases, most online and offline data, never the twain shall meet. And it's a real debate in organisations in terms of the resources and how we allocate them, because there's always this desire, rightly so, to prioritise our work with beneficiaries. But I know that many of us are having to re-look at that long and hard in order to maintain our financial health, if you like, and obviously build support for the future. So it's a huge question, which I think is firmly back in the boardroom, and we're going to have to embrace that change and fast.
So certainly we feel there's a strategic side of this, and there's lots of tactical things that you can do with technology. But when Tanya used the word investment there, I think that was a really good thing. Where when you're in a downturn, it's very easy to sort of keep struggling on, and try and keep your targets high and keep hitting your, doing everything as quickly as you can. Whereas maybe this could be a time to sort of more slow down and just accept that you're in a bad time and actually do more time for thinking and for planning, so that when you come out of the tough times, you're in a better position. So those sort of debates are the ones that CTT are definitely hoping the sector's going to be talking about and getting to grips with.
I come across quite a few charities who are wary to invest, and I would rather spend money on the things that they've been doing for years, like direct marketing, because it feels like a safer investment rather than trying something they haven't really tried before.
I mean, I feel really strongly about this. You do have to take some risks. So for me, there's a spectrum. There's do nothing, there's take a risk, and then there's go gambling. And taking a risk isn't the same as gambling. This is about a measured decision. And I think that organisations that will thrive through the recession will take some risks. And I think the recession can be an excuse for doing nothing sometimes. And that's just, you know, that's really not good enough in terms of the world that we live in right now.
I'm with you. I mean, our thoughts of prostate will be one man's dying every hour of prostate cancer. There's a sense of urgency in every man that's been diagnosed, and we as an organisation have to respond to that. And it's about getting the right level of risk. And I guess one of the risks for us would be that Movember's been this runaway success, but we need to make sure that the rest of the portfolio is there. So the right investment is key. But it's not just the fundraising products. You need to make sure that the database systems are kind of there. Otherwise, you're losing people like grains of sand for your hand.
I mean, we've found at Save the Children, by investing, that actually it has attracted probably more resources and better results than we'd ever imagined on so many fronts. So I think sometimes it can be just deemed as fundraising investment. There's no doubt it has to return. That's what your primary goal is. But that momentum and that level of ambition can actually attract so many other things as well.
Well, I was just wondering if anyone's got any views on Cancer Research's Dryathon, because I signed up at the beginning of January. Mm. There's a lot of advertising around it. To my shame, I only made it to about 7 days in. I owe them some money. But it's an interesting kind of high-profile investment in a new product, and I'll be interested to see what people's thoughts are.
Well, I think we're going to see more of this happening, aren't we? I mean, so social media is enabling a lot more of these great ideas to surface, and I think, you know, in future it's going to be the battle of the ideas rather than the battle of the execution. So something goes viral, it's because something's going to take off. Movember certainly did. I don't know, you know, whether this one does or not. Mm. We'll see.
And I think that's one of the crucial points. This is about selling ideas. It's not about selling, will you give me £2 a month? Will you chuck something in a bucket? You're selling an idea, and in this particular case, Dryathon, which I think is great, just plays into a psyche. It's playing into a trend that we know exists. You know, we all, you know, we've either drunk up or we've shoved all our beer to the back of the cabinet. And I think it's perfect. And again, it's back to thinking as consumer brands, if you like, as opposed to trying to sort of insert ourselves into popular culture. You have to take advantage of it and try and fly off the back of it.
Yeah, it's fantastic when the idea itself chimes in with your brand values. Mm. So people can see the sense of it, and as well, so
yeah,
exciting things that make sense, you know, they catch people's imagination.
And it also, in my mind, depends where the idea is generated. Do you have innovation teams, or do you listen to your supporters who will email you with something that's actually feasible and sounds like a winner in your innovation portfolio?
I think it's got to come from everywhere. I mean, this is talked about a lot, and you know, some of the, you know, largest and greatest organisations that exist today, you know, many of them outsource a lot of their innovation. But I think our experience at Save the Children is, it's still from a range of places. So the idea, for example, for our No Child Born to Die campaign, that came back directly off a brief. And as soon as we saw the idea presented, I mean, we hired the agency on the spot. We knew it absolutely hit the mark in terms of what we wanted to achieve. But then in other cases, things like our Christmas Jumper Day, which we ran for the first time this year, actually, that was totally just going into an existing trend. So arguably, that's something that exists in popular culture. So I don't think you can kind of close down or assume it's only going to come from one area. But what you do have to do is have your antennae up, and ideally an organisational process and system that spots those ideas and brings them in.
Thank you. That's the end of part one of this podcast on fundraising. In the next episode, I will ask you to share your secrets.
The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to the Guardian Voluntary Sector Network podcast. This is the second part of our episode on fundraising. I'm Bertie Bourigeon, and my three guests are...
Hi, I'm Tanya Steele. I'm Director of Fundraising at Save the Children.
Hi, I'm John Brewer. I work for Charity Technology Trust, and I'm Development Director.
Hi there, I'm Mark Bishop, Director of Fundraising at Prostate Cancer UK.
Well, thanks for the three of you to come back for the second part of this podcast. So recently there have been a few articles published which were quite alarming about the drop in charitable giving. So I'm not sure if I managed to find exceptional charities, but the income of Save the Children has more than doubled since 2005. I don't have the latest figures, but your income was around 333 million in 2011. So what's your secret?
Gosh, I think like all these things, there's no single silver bullet. But I mean, like all the causes sitting around the table is grounded in what it is we're trying to achieve as an organisation. And we have such incredible goals that we want to achieve for children that we've always said we know we will need to raise an awful lot of money and support in order to do that. So we really set about repositioning and rebuilding our fundraising, our communication structures to do that. And we're really pleased to now see the results starting to flow through. So there's absolutely about getting behind a goal. And it's the belief that sits behind that as well. You can put the best systems in place, but unless you passionately believe that you can and will achieve that goal, you'll never achieve that growth anyway.
And is there a moment when, as a charity, you look at your portfolio, you look at what's working, what's not working so well, and then just decide to stop some activities?
Yeah, and it's really hard. It's hard to stop things because they're usually bringing in some sort of incremental benefit or profit. You'll never run anything that's totally unprofitable. But what you are conscious of is leaving things in the portfolio that actually could be a distraction, or you could actually just close it down and start to invest and accelerate something else. But yes, we did aspects of that around some of our trading operations. We absolutely culled that back. We've prioritised pretty ruthlessly our investment around the areas that we know have grown and have grown the kind of income or the kind of external impact that we wanted to achieve. So that's an exercise we did both at the start of our strategy, but to be honest, it's ongoing. You've got to do it on a very regular basis. Now, it's not a knee-jerk reaction on a quarterly basis, but it's most definitely on an annual basis.
And are there any areas which are less popular?
I mean, I think there's lots of forms of what I call mass engagement that aren't performing as well. So I don't think that direct mail performs anywhere near as well as it used to. But to be honest, it depends on your audience and it depends on what your ask or your offer is as well. I know some organisations that can still run cold mail. I absolutely can't right now. So I think it's very varied. But for me, some of the traditional channels are getting harder and tougher. I think broadcast-based media, TV, radio, increasingly online, certainly I'm seeing more growth and movement, and it just feels a much more dynamic setting for us.
Mark, have you witnessed the same thing at Prostate?
So Prostate Cancer UK is a little bit smaller than Save the Children. We're £25 million. We're the largest men's health charity in the UK by kind of income. And we've had a lot of growth in recent times. Movember's helped there. But two things that have really made a difference in recent times was we realised with the London Marathon that we just were not going to win it on our own. And so we teamed up with, you'll remember this, Bertie, your old gang at Breast Cancer Care.
Yes, I am.
And we got together as two charities and said, look, we share something in common. We both have been turned down year on year. So why don't we put in a joint bid and just see where we get to? Because the worst that could happen is you just get one more rejection, albeit a shared one. But thankfully, the two charities won the 2012 Virgin London Marathon. And I think the lesson here is that sometimes success can be achieved not on your own, but with the right effective partnership with others. But you've got to find the right partner, and then you've got to accept it's not going to happen overnight. The key thing is you have to really work at the relationship and build honesty between the two charities. But if you get it right, then the rewards are there, because Prostate and Breast shared £1.3 million worth of income. And beyond that initial opportunity, the two charities are looking at other ways to work together. But you have to be brave enough in the first instance to say, we cannot win this on our own, but there's an opportunity to win it together. And I think the second thing that we've witnessed at Prostate is the power of merger. And this is not something that you can do every day of the week. And it's not an option not open to many charities, perhaps. But we've found that merging Prostate Cancer UK with Prostate Action to become a bigger entity together has made a massive difference. And it just means that donors are seeing one organisation that's there for men's health rather than two charities competing against each other. And I think that in the current economic climate, offering value for money by saying that we don't have two back offices is a really big, powerful kind of message.
I've heard lots of discussions about charity charity merging. How long does it take between the time of the idea is formed by maybe chief execs of a board of trustees to actually do the merger?
So, amazingly, from when our two boards of trustees met their version of the kind of Granita kind of moment, it was a matter of months, less than 6 months, from first conversation to merger. And I think that's principally because you had a medium-sized charity and a smaller-sized charity, so the scale of business allowed it to happen quicker. And I think just the will was there to kind of make it happen. But I've spoken to other charities in the sector, and generally mergers take a bit longer. And I think what we're finding is that the merger itself took place very quickly, but some of the back office functions, merging the database, takes time. So we set ourselves an ambition to get that done within the next 2-3 months. And it takes a while to kind of merge down the records and integrate your processes. So you've got the time it takes to do the merger, and then the time it takes to kind of see through the implications of a merger.
Which sounds to me slightly different from other technical projects where it's sometimes easy to implement a piece of technology, and it's the learning how to use it and actually making the most of it, the strategic points that takes longer. Whereas from what you're saying with a merger, it's then that the strategy is there and then it's bringing together two technologies. So John, do you have any tips for charities who have merged or are thinking of joining forces with another charity or sharing resources around the technical aspect?
Not so sure about tips. I would just, from a technical point of view, note that there are always, there's a lot more devil in the detail very often. And so therefore, while I would say that mergers might look like an easy option at a very high level, when you get down to it, it's something that's not always that, can be problematic. So, I would say think carefully before merging would be my immediate reaction. But obviously, if you can get it right, the rewards are massive.
But I think what we're also saying here is there's the benefit of mergers, but actually the whole conversation started on the basis of collaboration. In terms of this case, it was winning an amazing partnership, the London Marathon. And I think in this economic climate, I think there's every opportunity for charities to grow. There is every opportunity for charities to fail, but it creates a brilliant backdrop, an imperative, if you like, to look at collaboration, only where it makes sense, of course. But I think that's a stunning example of where that can work really, really well. And I think that sometimes we need to put a sense of competition or we're different to one side to actually consider the options to do that.
And Tanya, you are involved at the moment with a big campaign called IF to End World Hunger, which is a coalition of
100 charities. Yeah, absolutely.
Can you tell us a bit more about how this campaign came together?
Well, I guess the campaign has come behind the whole issue that if there were, there's enough food for everybody on this planet. But right now, we're not sharing it, or we don't have the right systems in place to ensure that everybody gets access to it or has their share of it. And, there have been huge campaigns like Make Poverty History in the past, and they did an enormous amount. We managed to really lift millions out of poverty through all the concessions that were achieved through that campaign. But the Achilles heel at the end of the day was hunger. And hunger has so many far-reaching implications, some of the very horrific immediate ones in terms of immediate starvation. But actually, there are often cycles of hunger that run through communities and societies that mean that children and families are undernourished, and it means that they don't develop properly, that they're unable to fight off basic illnesses. And actually, should they grow up to become an adult, they're often economically inactive because they've never, ever fully developed. So the cost of this on human potential is immense. So really what we're trying to challenge the G8 leaders, and of course the UK is hosting the G8, is around this whole issue of hunger and food, and actually some of the steps that we believe G8 leaders can take, whether it's around taxation, whether it's around agricultural policies, to really end this blight for good.
And did you find it easy to work with 100 charities?
I mean, it's a huge undertaking.
How long did it take?
I mean, it's really, we've been working on this now for probably 12 months, but in earnest for the last 6 to 9 months. And this came from a very initial idea of feeling within the sector, within the development community, that this was such a priority that we had to find a way to put it on the table. So we've been working in the background and certainly been lobbying the current government very, very hard to even consider for Cameron to use his G8 presidency in any way. So we were delighted to launch it. But in terms of ways of working, it's you coalesce behind a big idea, but actually you still have to create an organising structure, which is effectively what we've done. We've kind of segmented up a whole range of everything that we're doing in terms of policy work, media work, etc., etc. So it's a huge undertaking, but like all great ideas, it's achievable if you want it badly enough.
Well, John, coming back to you, and I know several charities who are exploring a social enterprise model to sell their services. What advice would you give to those charities?
Well, I think this is definitely, you're right, Bertie, this isn't a just a tactical response to the economic climate. This is a bit of a sea change in the way that the sector is thinking, I think. Certainly there was a recent charity UK LinkedIn group that asked the question about social enterprises and a flood of people getting in there. As a charity, we ourselves took the decision a few years ago to act more like a social enterprise. And we started out as a grant-giving organisation. We saw some successes, but there was a limit to the sort of impact that we could achieve with that, and found a way really of finding an income stream through admin fees. So we run the CT Exchange programme, which is enabling IT software donations to the voluntary sector. And for each of those, there's a small admin fee per transaction. And in doing that, we've been able to make sure that there's an income stream to cover our costs and to ensure our sustainability. Now, not everyone's got that potential. So really, you know, we would just encourage everybody to just get creative, just to sit around and just see what ways that you could sort of monetize and create transactions out of the value that you've got and the things that you have to offer.
Is that a model, Mark, that you've considered at some point for Prostate Cancer UK?
Well, at the moment, we don't receive any money from government in terms of the statutory provision for the services. And our income is entirely made up of voluntary income, principally the Movember side of things and then all the traditional income streams. And so I think the longer-term ambition for the charity would be that we believe that men deserve better in terms of the healthcare provision, and we would like to encourage the government of the day to support our research with funding and look at winning, ultimately, contracts to deliver healthcare through the NHS. And so at the moment, we're trying to inspire the NHS by delivering the services ourselves. Eventually, we'd like the NHS to share the burden with us.
Well, I think it is worth it just in the social enterprise space, just to waving a flag for the likes of The Big Issue and Fair Share, and you know, there are other great models out there, you know, that people could look to, and just encourage people to really sort of get creative, just to brainstorm, you know, what is there that you could be doing differently. And yeah, that's the final point I'd like to make.
Thank you, and obviously you'll be back for the last part of this podcast, where we'll be talking about digital.
The Guardian.
Hello, welcome back to the last part of the Guardian Voluntary Sector Network podcast on fundraising. I'm Bertie Boredon, and my three fundraising experts are Tania Steele from Save the Children. Hello, Tania.
Hi.
Mark Bishop from Prostate UK.
Hi there.
And Chandra from the Charity Technology Trust.
Hi there.
In the previous part of this podcast, we talked about fundraising ratios. We talked about different fundraising solutions. Now, my passion is digital, and it has been for many years, but I've witnessed or struggle with a divide between digital communication professionals and fundraisers. With social media, with peer-to-peer fundraising or crowdsourcing, do you think the situation is changing? Do you think that this divide is disappearing?
Well, Bertie, you opened the old can of worms there, and I think it's a broader issue that the traditional, almost cliché debate is between the divisions between fundraising and communications, because there are natural areas of overlap and difference there. And I think that you've got, broadly speaking, a communications functions for a charity that are there to tell the story, and the fundraising team to seek a response to the story, the need, the cause. But clearly those two areas overlap, and once you get into digital communications, you really get into a grey kind of area. We found Prostate Cancer UK recently with our Sledgehammer fund, with Bill Bailey kind of out there cracking nuts for us, is that partly it's traditional above-the-line campaign, and then when you get into the direct response with digital channels, it's really hard to work out who looks after each part of the kind of programme. So I wouldn't say there's bun fights internally, but there are bits and pieces that are quite difficult. You've got to work through who's leading on, and the most important thing is to make sure that, you know, all the detail gets done and you don't assume that somebody else is doing it for you.
Are you experiencing similar debates internally at Save the Children?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still a bit of a digital divide, if you like. And I think this happens when anything big and new comes along. And let's face it, digital is enormous. It has disrupted so many sectors. And in truth, I think it's disrupting ours, and rightly so, in a good way. But what we have, I think, is sometimes a number of digital professionals who really understand their space so well, but don't perhaps yet understand fundraising, and then fundraising who understand how things work traditionally, but really don't understand how digital works. And I think one of the challenges is, because digital is moving and continues to move really quickly, it's actually hard to keep pace with it. So really what we've focused on in Save the Children is having a bit more joint ownership between what we're trying to do. So you'll think about this in terms of a supporter journey, if you like, from start to finish. You can't just say, oh, well, fundraising does its bit and then hopefully something will pop up online. Actually, there's incredible learning in terms of what might be happening online or what's happening from an SMS point of view. So we've moved into much more a more integrated way of planning and executing, but a much more open ideas exchange. And whilst we have a core digital function where our absolute experts exist, we're actually also virtualising resources around the organisation, whether it's sat within the media team, whether it's sat within the fundraising team. But at the end of the day, this is just about making and ensuring that teams work together.
Sorry, buddy, is it not also fair to say that it's not just a skill for, it's more of a channel for the upcoming digital generation? You know, the gap is being bridged as younger people come into the teams. Are you finding that? Or?
Yeah, I think there's an element of that, definitely, because, you know, everyone's either on Facebook or, you know, they've got their smartphone. That definitely makes a difference. But I think also it's about understanding who your audience is and where they're at. And people are having conversations in very different places now from where they used to 10, 15 years ago. And it's a recognition from a digital expertise where that is, but also from a fundraising perspective in terms of how you go about capitalising on it and how you continue that conversation. So I think it's moving, but I do think there's still some more blending needed of those skills overall.
Well, there was a survey done recently that 76% of the top 100 UK charities have a digital strategy. So 76%, that's a good figure. But only 56% are signed up by the senior management team, which is just half of them. I think digital fundraising is not so much about fundraising, is not completely about digital. Do you think that fundraisers now will need to acquire new skills now or in the next couple of years?
Definitely. And I think they already are. And I would say fundraisers and anyone who is supporter facing. So, for example, from a Save the Children point of view, I'd include campaigners within that as well. And I think it's really easy to immediately assume that digital, well, wow, that's a great new fundraising channel. This is about a way of having a conversation or interacting with someone who might be interested in your cause. So you need to ensure, in the same way, whether it's a phone call or anything else, actually, it can. There's a way of stewarding that through your organisation and being very responsive to what that person wants. They might not want 20 callbacks on their mobile phone because, hey, that's incredibly intrusive. People take their mobile phones with them everywhere. It's not like your old fixed line phone at home. There's so many nuances that I think sit behind this. So, yes, it's a big question for fundraisers, but I think it's a question for the whole organisation.
How, as an organisation, do you start managing conversations, managing engagement, which are not happening in a media that you can control?
Well, I think the key is that you cannot manage them entirely. You've got to accept that social media in particular is about letting people talk on their own terms about you. And I think that as soon as you try and control, particularly Facebook and other social media channels, you're onto a good old beating kind of there. So I think that the first thing you have to do is to accept there are some things that will happen that you have no control or no absolute control over. And I think that what we noticed at Prostate Cancer UK was probably a year ago, we were trying to make sure that we only had one person in the organisation who was issuing kind of tweets and responses and stuff like that. But actually, you've got to train a number of staff and say that we're going to work in a devolved kind of way here and trust our staff to want to do the best thing by your cause. Train staff where there's kind of gaps and just see where you get to. And as long as people behave sensibly about it, it's no different, as you say, Tony, to a phone call or another kind of correspondence. I think just because it's new media doesn't mean that old principles of courtesy and just good practice don't exist.
And just as a quick survey, do you use social media yourself?
Yes, badly at times, if I'm truthful. Please don't look at my Facebook page. But I use Twitter when I travel, although I know I need to use it more regularly now and will be. But when I travel, I feel is a particularly active means to do it. But certainly we use it, all those media across the organisation.
Well, it's very, very, I mean, yeah, I don't want to take the conversation immediately away from this, because I mean social media is very important, but the other skills, Bertie, your first question about, you know, general skills. I mean, Tanya, you were mentioning earlier about the joined upness and getting working across the team. I think there are loads and loads of skills that are needed, particularly, you know, as things start to get faster and faster, you almost need to slow down and be able to get more strategic about what you're doing and be able to put the supporter at the heart of everything that you're doing, and then join up around that. So the sort of things that I'm thinking there about user experiences online, and but then also offline as well. There's been quite a debate about this year in the press about events that have been around joining up online and offline, and how you make those two things work together.
It was amazing in the very recent Obama campaign how online and offline worked together quite incredibly. I mean, this, you know, they'd employed everything from ex-Google experts to rocket scientists, you name it, and some of the modelling on a state-by-state basis was impressive, as was the online push backwards and forwards. But actually, when it came down to it as well, they needed the people out doing the door knocking as well. So the way in which they blended this sort of ground operation, if you like, with the incredible online resources was really impressive, and I think we can all learn from that.
Oh, it's definitely a model, you know, for the voluntary sector, absolutely, that you can empower local voluntary representatives and devolve campaigns and, you know, push things out. You can have almost like intranets and extranets, and you can give people tools to go out and do things for you on the doorstep, absolutely.
Have you started to have conversations internally about getting the rest of the organisations behind the fundraising team, not just as a support function, but as core fundraisers?
Well, I think what we've done at Prostate in recent times, and it's very much in its infancy, is to say that the people we're supporting who've got prostate cancer, using our website, using our online forums and our booklets, previously we didn't put anything in our literature saying, would you like to give something back? Would you like to be a part of the solution for the next man and his family? And we've embarked on a programme of putting, let's say, kind of marketing-type messages into all of our literature and online forums and services to say to people, we're here to help you, but if you'd like to give something back, not just money, it's your time and campaigning, then do so. And I think a lot of charities have a nervousness on service delivery that, you know, somebody is vulnerable and you want to protect them and you shouldn't ask them to give back. But I think what I would say is actually sometimes the best form of treatment and therapy and support is to inspire somebody to want to make a difference beyond themselves.
Have you seen any results yet from
No, too early days. I mean, actually, the biggest result has been an internal victory that we want to do this, and the nervousness around it has been overcome, and that the organisation believes that we want to support people, but not be afraid of asking people to support us and be part of a community on behalf of men's health. So that's internal victory. Where it leads to might take a year or so to see.
How was it received by your support, by your beneficiaries?
Too early to say. I mean, broadly speaking, the best supporters for Prostate Cancer UK are people who have benefited from our services, who have been through the darkest days of being told they might die of prostate cancer, to going through treatment options and support from the charity. And these people know damn well that the charity made a difference to their lives and would almost be annoyed if we hadn't engaged them to make a kind of difference. So I guess, Tanya, it's a kind of different situation to Save the Children, where our beneficiaries are in the UK and can make a difference to the cause rather than just be beneficiaries.
I mean, I think that's incredibly powerful to involve beneficiaries in perhaps taking the cause forward and perhaps their way of not just giving back, but they've experienced it themselves And I think to have beneficiaries, volunteers, to tell those stories is so powerful. It is an incredibly authentic form of fundraising. And I think that's critical for any organisation. I guess going back to your original question in terms of should everybody fundraise? Well, I guess you'd expect me to say yes. But that doesn't mean it has to be, you know, 100% or 50% of their day-to-day activity. It's a way of thinking in terms of what are the opportunities to build as much support as possible for my cause, regardless of what it is that you work in on a day-to-day basis. And certainly at Save the Children, I have to say, I do think that the vast majority of our people that work within the organisation and our volunteers do feel a huge responsibility towards that. And it's almost certainly contributed to our success.
So thank you very much for your time. Thank you, Tanya, John and Mark for joining me today. I will be back soon with a new topic and new guests. But if you would like to get in touch or to suggest a theme or want to be in a Voluntary Sector Network podcast, you can email me at b@bertie.fr or find the details on the page of the website.